Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good news, bad news, crazy news for conservatives, as always, today. And our good martini actually comes from reporting that Jim himself did, and especially an interview he did with RNC Chairman Reince Priebus about how things might change in the primary season come 2016. And that cycle, specifically, there were 20 debates in the primary season for this last election cycle. Priebus is definitely interested in reducing that number, possibly just one a month leading up to the key primaries, with definite expectations that candidates would show up for those and not show up for ones not sanctioned by the party. Jim, I think a lot of people thought there were way too many, but is this too much party meddling? What did you come away with?
Well, worth noting, we had our chat about the RNC's new Growth and Opportunity Project. By the way, notice the acronym, GOP. and basically, it starts out with a five-member panel, but their plan is to talk to hundreds of people across the country about what the RNC is doing and how they can do it better. Basically, you know, some people are characterizing it as the autopsy of what went wrong in 2012. And the vibe is actually less about looking back and more about what do they need to be doing both in 2014 and 2016, hitting every possible area, get out the vote, digital, campaign infrastructure, all kinds of stuff. But what I asked him about, because in some of the descriptions of it, one of the things they said is they'd be looking at the primary process and perhaps changing that in a way to strengthen the party. And he was the one who actually brought up debates and basically said that a couple people believe that the debate process turned into chaos by the for much of the season. As you said, there were 20. A lot of folks did not like some of the moderators. I'm sure many listeners remember George Stephanopoulos asking about the states banning birth control and such. And so there was a sense of this turned into something that did not present the party well. It turned into a kind of a cacophonous noise. And you're probably saying, well, how can the RNC limit the debates? They're put on by the media people, and the presidential candidates decide to do it. Well, with a three-quarter vote in the Republican National Committee, you can do a heck of a lot. Among them, dock candidates a certain amount of delegates for participating in debates that are not authorized by the RNC, and you can penalize them, or you can alternatively give them bonus delegates for participating in debates that are authorized by the RNC. And that one-a-month thing that he was describing, which is kind of a hypothetical, I'm sure you'll hear a lot of debates about the pros and cons of this kind of an approach, but I think it is useful that somebody is trying to bring structure to what turned into a very chaotic system. And what, as he described, and it's accurate, let's say you have 10 people running for president. By the way, I think that's probably too many, that you end up having 7 or 8 of them with low name recognition and just basically needing to appear at any debate they get because it's the best publicity they're going to get. If you are a little-known House member, it elevates you to be up on the stage right next to the front runner. So you end up in a circumstance where of those 10 candidates, you got 7 or 8 they're going to show up to any time, any invitation by any news network whatsoever that they can't afford to turn down an MSNBC invitation or a, you know, Bloomberg News invitation with Charlie Rose or anything like that. And I kind of like the idea of somebody coming in and saying, look, not all of these debates are good for the party as a whole. And some of these debates are not good for the candidates themselves. In a way, you almost need somebody to save the candidates from themselves, because in their desperation for publicity, they will agree to participate in events that are probably not good ideas. If the Huffington Post and Current TV offer to sponsor a Republican presidential debate, you're going to get ambushed. You're not going to come out looking well from that. So I am fairly encouraged by this. It's worth noting this is all kind of very much in the planning stages. But it's nice to know that the party does have some leverage here and can say, you know what, we would like to see a debate primary process that spotlights the best of our candidates that doesn't turn into a succession of gotcha questions and events that are designed to make the party look like a freak show, to provide, you know, fodder for late night comics and things like that.
We were joking back last year about how there were, and in many cases, 2 a week, before the first actual votes were cast. And so, as you said, they're still playing around with the actual number, but streamlining that to some extent would be good while still having opportunity for lower named candidates to at least have a chance to get their message across. One thing I'd also like to see is maybe the debates continuing a little further, because in this cycle, once we got to Florida, that was it. I mean, there was still a relatively competitive race. Newt was still somehow viable. Santorum was in the mix, and obviously Romney was doing very well. But after the lead-up to Florida, we never got another debate.
By having two a week, it definitely made the value of each individual debate lessened. You know,
right.
That scarcity, in a way, creates value. And so even if you think, you know, look, you know, no one's anti-debate. Debates can be very good, both for the party and for the candidates and for the electorate at large. I just don't think we necessarily need 20. And if you cut them in half, 10 debates would still be plenty, I think.
Absolutely.
And, you know, maybe even less than that.
Absolutely right. I think that would be a pretty good balance. All right, on to a martini number two now, and this follows on yesterday's good martini as the Michigan legislature signed right-to-work, passed right-to-work legislation, and Governor Snyder signed both of those bills later in the day. Kudos to him. But what we saw on the grounds of the Michigan State Capitol, sadly, was not a surprise, but it was horrific. The thuggery by organized labor, I mean, it's not often that the actions actually exceed the reputation, but organized labor seems to pull this off just about every time. Punching Steven Crowder in the face, he's a Fox News contributor and a comedian, taking out knives to take down the American for Prosperity tent, demolishing the cart of a hot dog vendor who is an institution in Lansing and had nothing to do with this debate. These people are out of control, and all the liberal media can do is pretend that the video of Crowder getting punched in the face was fake. I mean, Jim, this is just, if it wasn't so brutal, it would be funny.
There are two aspects that make this a bad martini and one slight, you know, one little bit of good news. It is ludicrous that these union members believe they have the right to behave this way. You have a free right to gather. You have a free right to protest. And they were allowed into the state capitol and allowed to wave their signs and stuff like that. What they felt, though, was that the presence of Crowder or Americans for Prosperity or anybody else who disagreed with them was somehow unacceptable and that they were allowed to physically assault them. I mean, I don't care how much you dislike Americans for Prosperity. They had a permit for their tent. They had every right to set up there, and they did. I don't care. You know, I like Steven Crowder. I think he's a great guy and a very talented comedian. Nothing he says or does warrants punching him. And it's kind of astounding that in the lefty circles, this is a – whether it's wrong to punch Steven Crowder is a very debatable point. They are very evenly divided, and – all morning long, Crowder has been spotlighting tweets from people telling him he deserved what he got. He should have been, you know, beaten more, yada, yada, yada. Just kind of appalling, the attitude of entitlement and thuggishness that you find in union circles. And look, you could say it's not all union members, but I didn't see too many folks in that crowd trying to pull back their violent buddies, okay?
Right.
I mean, you watch the YouTube videos, and there's just this atmosphere of hate and a desire to lash out that is spectacularly ugly. I saw a couple of folks arguing that Steven Crowder's existence and the Americans for Prosperity tent were provocations. Well, if all it takes to provoke you into a violent rage is the presence of somebody who disagrees with you, you are not fit for this society. Okay, I mean, you really should be locked up if you can't stand somebody having a view different from you. This is going to be fantastic for sales of liberal fascism of Jonah Goldberg. That's about the only good news you can find here. The other thing, I did not see this, but I saw other people talking about this. Apparently Joe Scarborough on Morning Joe played the Crowder tape of him getting punched. So the news blackout was interrupted a little bit. It's by Joe Scarborough, a right-of-center guy, perhaps not right-of-center enough for some of our listeners, but I give him credit for at least trying to put this before Mika Brzezinski and the other lefties at MSNBC and saying, hey, you know, this doesn't fit the template of the violent tea parties, the noble unions. You know, this is thuggery. And why is political violence only worth denouncing when it comes from one direction? So
I think it's great that we're in the internet age and camera phones and all that sort of stuff, because it was just the three major networks. It's probable that this would never even been made public. And the card check bill, remember the whole thing over secret ballots and unions? It's pretty clear from yesterday that not having secret ballots, there might just be a little bit of pressure at some of these union votes for people to go right way.
So, I'd like to tell these folks, I'm not voting your way.
Yeah, exactly. If you like all your teeth, that's not a good idea. All right, on to martini number three now. Unfortunately, something a little bit lighter. And Jim, I don't know what you're doing over the next 9 days, but if you're like some people, you're either planning to rejoice at the end of the world according to the Mayan calendar, or you're in a doomsday scenario, hunkering down, hoping somehow to survive the apocalypse here. The fact that so many people from China to Europe, all over the place, really taking this seriously.
I just want to observe, Greg, it says something about our news environment that the end of the world is our lighter, hot, more fun martini, to end this day. As I observed in the Jolt Company, there's now only 9 shopping days until the end of the world instead of the usual, 13 or 14 or so you'd have for getting your Christmas gifts. I am rather skeptical of that notion, the idea that some sort of astrological time clock that the this one civilization got the precise date that this is all going to end. And I've heard a lot of folks saying that actually this is a complete and total misinterpretation of the Mayan beliefs and hieroglyphics and all that jazz. I suppose if we all wake up on the 21st and, the sky is on fire and meteors are flying and Danny Glover is the president of the United States and he's shuffling us all into a couple of the special people get to go into arcs and stuff like that. Then I guess, they'll have the last laugh. We were wrong for, you got us, Mayans. Good job. And we'll have to remember what they said next time around. But if not, if you really are totally convinced the world is ending, please send checks for all of your remaining funds for Greg Corumbus, care of Radio America, and Jim Garrity, care of National Review. Because, hey, you can't take it with you. And, I'm willing to take that chance just in case the world – I don't want you to have to carry all that wealth into the afterlife. So I am there for you, America. I am there for you, world. I'll take yen and euros. Well, maybe not euros. They're not really worth anything anymore. But anyway, send all your gold and stuff. We will see what happens on the 22nd. And, my guess is that, everyone who put off buying their Christmas presents is going to say, oh, gee whiz, I only have like 2 or 3 days to buy presents now. Because I really was counting on the world ending on the 22nd.
All right, here are some of the more common theories that NASA and others are trying to debunk. First of all, the internet has helped feed the frenzy, spreading rumors that a mountain in the French Pyrenees is hiding an alien spaceship that will be the only vessel to escape the destruction.
I knew it!
We also have a rogue planet called Nibiru, which will emerge from its hiding place behind the sun and smash into the Earth. Also, a couple of different men in China are predicting a world-ending flood, so both are building arcs. One guy dumped $160,000, his entire life savings, into the 70-foot by 50-foot vessel, and another guy has built a 3-ton yellow steel ball, 13-feet diameter vessel to survive a volcano, tsunami, earthquake, or nuclear meltdown. So they're going to be really disappointed. You think you're going to be disappointed to have to go buy Christmas presents? These guys, probably a little more so.
The indestructible sphere is kind of cool. I'll give him a little bit of credit for creativity on that one.
Jim, tomorrow I guess we're safe, so I'll talk to you then.
America, enjoy the last few 3 martini lunches. You know what? I mean, really, on the 21st, or on the 20th, we should have 4. Just in case.
Just in case. Jim, talk to you tomorrow. See ya.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.